Good evening. This is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is Peter S. Alagona. He's an environmental historian, conservation scientist, nature culture geographer, and professor of environmental studies at the University of California, Santa Barbara. And we're talking about his new book, The Accidental Ecosystem, People and Wildlife in American Cities. Peter, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me, Mark.
I really enjoyed this book. I'm one of those people, I have a mammal list for my backyard. I live in the city of Worcester, and we've even had a moose down at the end of our street within the last couple of years, even though we're in a very urban environment. But this is a book that talks about why and how wild animals are showing up in an urban environment, which seems to have gotten richer in species of wildlife. What brought you to doing the research on this book?
Well, first of all, Mark, it's interesting and kind of amazing to hear that you've had a moose
well,
backyard.
Well, we didn't. When I grew up, let me tell you, we're in Massachusetts, okay? We're in Massachusetts. When I grew up, there were no moose in the state.
That's right. Well, that's a great point, is that, you know, you said in the last few years, then you said, you know, when I grew up. And so I think what you're speaking to is
your book.
A transformation.
Yeah,
that's happened over the last several decades, you know.
It's the weirdest thing. I mean, I can tell you, I'm a person who, from a very young age, has been interested in natural history. I grew up outside of Boston along the Charles River, moved to Worcester, which is the second largest city in Massachusetts, and I thought, well, I'm living in a city. I'll get some birds at feeders. But we've had bears, foxes, coyotes, and the gamut. And my list is really, really long. And that's what your book is about. And that's why I found it so interesting.
Well, you know, if you go back several decades, then what you'd find if you kind of surveyed people that were studying wildlife, studying ecosystems at that time, no one would have really predicted that we would have been in this situation now, where, in a sense, we have more wildlife of more kinds in American cities than we've really had in at least the past 150 years in most regions, and in some cases, ever. And so this is a transformation that has really happened largely since World War II, but really mostly since the 70s and 80s. And so for folks like you and me, it's something that we've seen in our lifetimes as animals have appeared more commonly in cities and places where we don't expect to see them. And so this book is really about that story. And I have to say that, you know, you asked how I had gotten to this point. You know, I spent the first decade or so of my career focusing on endangered species issues, so wildlife conservation and management problems where the species are rare, and by definition, most people really almost never see them, right? So most endangered species are creatures that we're trying to save, but they're very rare. They're creatures that most people don't interact with. But even as I was working on that project, I was one of those folks who was focusing on these species that we don't see very often. I kind of realized that there was a whole other story that was going on.
That's right.
Where people were interacting more and more with all kinds of creatures in urban areas. And so this is sort of the flip side of that coin, and I wanted to pursue this, to better understand this, to understand how cities were filling up with wildlife, and why this happened in a way that no one had really predicted decades earlier. So the story sort of unfolds from there.
This is a book that's also about how we should value and foster urban wildlife. A lot of times, people who are not attuned to wildlife freak out if they have a fox run through their backyard, or if they see a coyote or something. I mean, right in Massachusetts, it's coyote panic. If a coyote walks down a street, everybody's taking their kids in and stuff like that. Now, granted, if you let your cat out, and if you have a little toy dog, and you're not keeping it on a leash, you're going to run into problems with the coyotes. But by and large, we need to learn how to live with this wildlife.
Well, you know, I think that there are a couple reasons why people express so much fear and surprise when they see unfamiliar creatures in their communities. I mean, one is just simply the fact that they are unfamiliar, and that when you see something new, it's often people assume it might be a reason for concern. And so that's one.
Well, there's a lot of rabies paranoia.
There's a lot of rabies paranoia, and that's been around for a long time as well.
I know.
Much more paranoia than actual rabies, but it is a concern, and we can talk a little bit more about that. You know, the other reason, though, I think, is that we've been taught in the United States, in part because of that history where wildlife experts assumed that wild creatures belonged in traditionally wild places. Everybody else really does, too. And so we expect to see wild creatures when we go to a place like Yellowstone or Yosemite, right? We don't expect to see them as much in our backyard. And so when we do, we're often surprised. We don't know what to do. We assume it might be a problem. But this is something that is happening more and more often. We need to learn to live with it. And the good news is that when you do see wild creatures like coyotes, you know, in your neighborhood, chances are it's not really a problem at all. You know, folks who study these animals, particularly carnivores in urban areas, and carnivore is a little bit of a misnomer because although an animal like a coyote is part of the lineage of carnivores, they actually are largely omnivores. And so they're not just going around eating entirely animals. They're eating all kinds of things, including vegetation and fruits and berries. But when you see them in your neighborhood, you know, if they're just kind of going about their own business, if they're wandering around doing their thing, if they're just passing through, then they're almost certainly not a problem. If you see an animal in distress, then it's best to call the authorities, have them come in, investigate the problem, and check it out. That's a good thing to do. But otherwise, they're just passing through. They're sharing their space with us. And the more we learn to live with them, the better off we'll all be.
One of the things I found interesting in your book is tracing the changes in urban animal populations in New York City. And the story of New York City and animal life is really indicative of a lot of the larger cities, especially on the East Coast. For many years, people don't realize this, but an enormous number of farm animals lived in New York City.
So Mark, one of the stories that I tell in the book is really the story of several phases in this history. So the first phase is really a period where the big settlements that were established in the United States that later became our biggest cities, the trading posts, the commercial centers, were established in areas that had previously had large and prosperous indigenous communities. And those indigenous communities were there because there were a lot of resources in those places. They were strategically located. And so a place like New York is a perfect example. You know, the Lenape people lived there and were extremely prosperous, a wealthy indigenous society in that region because they had access to all kinds of natural resources, foods, a diverse suite of ecosystems providing these things, just a really productive and rich biological environment. And so New York sprouts up, you know, as a city, as a settlement, and later as a big city, in a place where wildlife naturally congregated, at the intersection between land and sea, between ecosystems that are more typical of New England, like where you live, versus the Mid-Atlantic to the south of New York. It had, you know, estuaries, it had uplands, it had forests, it had meadows, all of these things packed into one place. And so people, you know, are surprised when they hear that New York has a lot of wildlife around it. But the truth is that New York was cited, New York grew up in a place that wildlife naturally congregated. And
that's
that is actually true of many cities in the United States. Cities in the United States are disproportionately, particularly our biggest cities, are disproportionately located in areas that have an unusual share of the biological richness and diversity of the country. And so we can expect that if we allow some creatures to return, they naturally will.
But in New York City, the amount of things like pigs and horses back in the early 1800s, was enormous. So there was a lot of animal life in the city. It just wasn't wildlife. Like you quote, in 1820, New York City had 20,000 pigs.
Yes, that's the next phase of the story, is that early on in the development of many of our biggest cities, a lot of the wildlife was kind of cleared out. So it's returned recently, some of it, but a lot of it was cleared out pretty early. And you're absolutely right that by the 18th and 19th centuries in cities like New York and Philadelphia and Boston, those wild creatures that had existed there before were replaced with a whole kind of menagerie of urban barnyard animals. And so creatures that we now associate with farms were living in the cities in huge numbers. And so this is, of course, horses, we know that, but also pigs and cows and chickens, and also feral cats and dogs and other kinds of domesticated animals lived in cities in enormous numbers. They weren't really cleared out of cities and moved into the countryside or into people's homes as pets until the late 19th and early 20th centuries. And so there's an interesting thing that happens there in that Victorian era when a lot of these reforms were going on, public health and safety reforms, sanitation reforms, animal welfare, all of these things that changed that. But then you get this period from about 1920 to 1950 or 60 when cities have fewer animals of any kind living in them than any time before, because the wild creatures were cleared out, then the domesticated animals were cleared out, and then there were very few left. It was only after that, after World War II, that some of those wild creatures then start to return. And so that's part of this bigger historical picture that I'm trying to paint in the book.
A good example is the eastern gray squirrel in New York City.
Yeah.
A lot of people may find it surprising, but they were virtually extirpated from the city.
You know, Mark, it's funny. When I wrote that part of the book and used the eastern gray as an example of this, I didn't anticipate that that would be one of the stories that people would be so interested in.
Oh, it's fascinating.
But it is. But it is. And the reason is because it's almost impossible for some of us to picture many of the cities we live in now without a bunch of squirrels around, right?
Oh, yeah.
But they weren't there. Squirrels were one of these creatures that were sort of wiped out throughout much of their historic range. I mean, if you look at the northeastern United States, you know, the felling of forests, logging, clearing of areas for farmlands, that eliminated natural habitat. Squirrels were hunted for food, for fur, but also because they were considered pests in some areas. And so eastern gray squirrels were pretty much eliminated from large areas of the East Coast, you know, by the beginning of the 19th century, by the late 18th century. And so it was only later that they were able to come back because cities became leafier. People started to plant trees. It was actually illegal in some areas to plant trees in cities in the 18th century. Believe it or not, they were considered a fire hazard, like a public safety threat at times when cities were, you know, constructed mostly of wood buildings. But people also reintroduced eastern gray squirrels. People kept them as exotic pets. And so these creatures that we think of now as being absolutely like just these quintessential urban dwellers and are native to the region were actually absent for a long period of time, in part because of this history of transformation of land, of habitats, and of our relationships with these other creatures in these places. So eastern grays are a perfect example of that.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is Peter S. Alagona. He's an environmental historian, conservation scientist, nature culture geographer, and professor of environmental studies at the University of California, Santa Barbara. His new book, it's really an interesting read, The Accidental Ecosystem, People and Wildlife in American Cities. Peter, one of the things that you talk about, and I find this really interesting, is one of the reasons that wildlife is returning or coming into the city is we've brought this country into the cities, especially with the parks of people like Frederick Law Olmsted.
So, you know, during the 19th and early 20th centuries, there was a period there when people really rethought what cities were supposed to be and what they were for. We moved from this kind of early modern city in which, you know, there was not a whole lot of planning. There were barnyard animals everywhere. People were crammed into tenements oftentimes. There was a lot of pollution. You know, that city that you can imagine from a couple hundred years ago. And people started to really rethink cities as places for people that could be healthier environments, that could be more calming environments, that could be more conducive to different kinds of social and civic life. And so Frederick Law Olmsted, the parks, the parkways, the walkways, the promenades that he designed that we know very well, places like Central Park and many other places too, were part of that movement. But, you know, Olmsted, even though he was very interested in ecology, he was very interested in vegetation and plants, he studied them, he thought about succession, he thought about how the trees he planted in Central Park would grow and look 50 or 100 years later and how they would interact with the ecosystem then, he was thinking mostly about plants and he was thinking mostly about people. He was thinking about how having a lusher, greener urban environment would benefit the people who lived there. What he didn't really anticipate was that designing these places would attract animals like raccoons and coyotes and white-tailed deer as they came back, which I'm sure you know very well.
Yep.
And so these decisions that were made decades ago, or even centuries ago in some cases, that were made for other reasons, often to benefit people, ended up decades later, moving toward today, benefiting some other creatures that have come back and recolonized urban environments along with us. And so this is why I call the book The Accidental Ecosystem. It's because decisions we made, people made decades ago and often for other reasons, ended up having unintended effects for other species much later on, and we're really seeing that today.
You also talk about these pastoral cemeteries, and right here in Massachusetts, we have a great example that's talked about in your book, Mount Auburn Cemetery in Cambridge.
Yeah. Yeah, Mount Auburn is a perfect example of this transition. You know, before cemeteries like Mount Auburn, graveyards were these very compact, very crowded kinds of spaces, you know, maybe like one city block or a half a city block. But those were often the only green spaces in many cities before the parks movement, you know, of the late 19th century. And so a place like Mount Auburn, this sprawling, rolling, wooded space, rethinking what a cemetery could be in terms of both a value to the community, but also just kind of like a gathering place for people who are interested in plants, who wanted to have a little bit of green space and be outside, as well as to serve the purpose of a cemetery. That was something that came along as part of this parks movement. But again, it was this situation in which this place that was thought of as a benefit to people who were grieving, but also local members of the community, turned out to be this ideal habitat for many creatures that had lost their woodland habitats, decades earlier, and now could come back to a place like Mount Auburn and see it as almost a kind of nature reserve in a way, in which they could stage their comeback. And, you know, these green spaces in many of these urban areas also provided kind of staging grounds for creatures that would then move further into urban spaces. And so what you start to see is you see creatures kind of commuting back and forth between patches of green space where they might hide out in the day when people are scurrying around, when there are lots of cars on the road, and then come out in the evening where they can forage in urban environments that are rich in food and water, during a time of the day when they're probably less likely to encounter a lot of people. And so in this way, the changes both kind of at this like site level, these kind of local changes and parks, shape what's going on regionally in terms of wildlife populations and the ability of some creatures to survive in urban spaces where they might not have been able to do so decades earlier without the benefit of those green spaces like Mount Auburn.
And people, cities are also now setting aside open spaces, either adjacent or in the city, as recreation areas. And you have several great examples talked about in your book, Golden Gate National Recreation Area, and then Fresh Kills on Staten Island. Can you talk about Fresh Kills?
Yeah, this is an example of a repurposing of urban space from kind of an industrial era into a kind of post-industrial era. So Fresh Kills was the largest landfill in the New York area. It received trash from New York for many decades. It's located on Staten Island, not too far from the city. And it had always been, for folks who live on Staten Island and in that community, it had always been a concern, an eyesore. It attracted a lot of unwanted wildlife, including a lot of scavengers like seagulls. And they just thought of it as kind of an insult. You know, why should our community be receiving the trash from wealthier communities on Manhattan, for example? And so Fresh Kills eventually closed down. It was scheduled to close down in the late 90s. It opened back up briefly to receive some debris after September 11th. But then in the last 20 years, it's been filled, covered, capped, and has now been slowly converted into the largest urban green space,
wow,
largest park really in New York City. And as a result of that, it started to attract wild creatures that hadn't been seen there in a very, very long time. Everything from beavers to bald eagles, to a wide variety of water birds. We see, of course, lots of deer on Staten Island. We also have seen coyotes. And so this is an area that, you know, for a long time was considered thought of as not only an eyesore, but as a public health threat, as kind of an icon of social inequality, and is now becoming an open space of tremendous value to the people who live in that community, and is also kind of being rewilded into a new kind of urban ecosystem that's housing creatures that people are just astonished to see there and never thought would be resilient enough to come back within a few years of this starting to turn into more of a natural space again. And so that's just an example of how things that people do for certain reasons can really affect the ability of wildlife who are seeing the landscape in other ways to inhabit it and to share habitats with us. And it also shows just how resilient some of these creatures really are.
You mentioned bald eagles, and it's interesting because we now have bald eagles breeding in the city of Worcester. Now, if you had asked me 20 years ago if that was going to be possible, I would have laughed. And the other species that's really changing their relationship to humanity is common ravens. Now, in the East, common ravens were, when I started birding 40 years ago, that was a big deal to see one in the state. And now we have them nesting under railroad overpasses and other sites in the city. So some of this is also being driven by, it seems, changes in animals' behavior, that they're becoming more tolerant of human presence and actually are learning to take advantage of urban spaces.
Well, if you look at bald eagles and ravens, there are a couple of things going on there. One is that, you know, birds like that, predatory birds, larger carnivorous birds, were really persecuted decades ago. And so the Migratory Bird Treaty Act of 1918 was a big step. The Bald Eagle Protection Act of 1940 was a big step. But, you know, bald eagles really respond to things that sometimes people don't quite associate with them or think about, like water quality. Water quality is often a situation in which excludes bald eagles from certain ecosystems. And so the Clean Water Act, which was really not designed largely to save wildlife, was designed to protect people, really ended up being a huge benefit for creatures like bald eagles that eat a lot of fish and that often live near aquatic ecosystems. And so that's, you know, the bald eagle story is a fascinating one, also because, like ravens, you know, those are animals that we associate oftentimes with wild places, you know, with national parks, with Alaska, with remote landscapes. And yet these are very resilient animals, and they're very adaptable, much more so than people ever thought in the past. And so, you know, bald eagles, but also ravens, are now using infrastructure in creative ways that people never would have guessed decades earlier to be able to allow themselves to survive in urban spaces. In some cases, this is actually a form of adaptation, a form of evolution.
Yep. And you talk about cities as evolution laboratories in the book.
That's right, right.
Ravens here in Massachusetts, like I said, 30 years ago, they were incredibly rare. They're, one of the things they started using were microwave relay towers as nesting areas. Then they sort of spread out from that to especially underpasses that they seem to, and railroad ones are good because there's not a lot of traffic except for the occasional train. And wild turkeys. When I started birding in the 70s here, there were no wild turkeys. They had been extirpated from the state as we cleared the state forests. And then they slowly came back. They're now an urban bird. I had a flock of 6 wild turkeys I had to support all winter. This last winter, they showed up. And, you know, I have a postage stamp backyard. And you have 6 turkeys back there. There's not a lot of room for anything else. And I felt so bad for them. And, you know, I started putting out a lot of feed. And they came every single day. And now they've spread out and they're looking for new areas to breed. But it's amazing to me to have seen this in my lifetime, the changes in the animal populations in urban areas.
So, Mark, we could talk about the specifics of each case, the particulars of each species, what they're doing, why they're seeming to succeed in these places. But if we zoom out, I think there are a couple things we can really take away from this. One thing is that a lot of creatures have turned out to be way more adaptable in an evolutionary sense, but also just in terms of their behaviors than people would have really understood decades ago. And also some creatures have turned out to be way more resilient.
Yep.
Right? And that means a lot of different things for a lot of different kinds of wildlife. But the ability to bounce back from low populations is an example of resilience. And so I think that in a way, this is a positive and kind of hopeful development to see creatures adapting to human-dominated landscapes, to our transformed planet, and some of them really succeeding. But, you know, there are certain kinds of creatures that do succeed in urban environments where many others don't.
Right.
I think it's important to remember that urbanization is a major driving force of biodiversity loss, both in the United States and around the world. So that's really important to understand. But there are some creatures that can do really well in those spaces.
But,
and if you look at the kinds of qualities that those animals have, they often have qualities like being relatively intelligent, being a generalist, meaning they can survive in a lot of different kinds of environments, being tolerant of being around large numbers of other members of their species, and also being omnivores is a real benefit.
That's right.
And Mark, if you put all of those qualities together, then you start to paint a picture of the kind of species that can tend to do well in urban environments. And those creatures often have a lot of qualities that are a lot like ours.
We're going to have to, Peter, we're going to have to stop there. We're completely out of time.
Relatively intelligent sometimes, you know, they start to look a lot like us. People don't want to think of rats as being like people, you know, but there's a reason we use them in labs, right?
Peter, we got to stop. We're completely out of time. It's Peter. We're out of time.
Basic biological ways. Yes.
My guest tonight has been Peter S. Alagona. He's an environmental historian, conservation scientist, nature culture geographer, and professor of environmental studies at the University of California, Santa Barbara. His new book, it's really important to read, The Accidental Ecosystem, People and Wildlife in American Cities. We could talk about this book for years. Peter, it's been a pleasure.
Thank you so much, Mark.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.